and welcome back to the Loop Marketing Podcast. Today we are joined by Quiggy's SVP of Marketing and Innovation, Ryan Green, and our Director of Innovation, Savannah Westbrock, as they discuss and demystify generative artificial intelligence. In this episode, you'll learn the potential uses and limitations of generative AI tools, why AI is such a popular topic at this point in our history, and how to navigate these powerful but still imperfect tools to get the best results. Let's get started.
So welcome to the Loop Marketing Podcast. My name is Ryan Green. I'm the Senior Vice President of Marketing and Innovation at Quiggy. And today I have tapped one of my employees, Savannah Westbrock, who is our Innovation Director and the founder of our Innovation Department here at Quiggy. Thanks for coming on the podcast. I kind of forced you to, so you didn't have much option.
Yeah, I think this is going to be really great. I'm excited to have kind of a looser conversation with you about AI. We have 7 years together of bouncing around on topics like this and making kind of loose predictions, critiquing tech that we see in the space. So I think knowing everything that has so rapidly changed, not only with performance AI that we've been using constantly as programmatic buyers, but also now with generative AI affecting marketing in so many different ways, it's going to be a fun conversation.
Yeah, greatly looking forward to it. And this has been a long time coming. You know, Quiggy's been pretty quiet about generative AI, and that has been a very conscious decision, knowing how impactful generative AI can be, how headline driven the conversation has been too. We wanted to be very deliberate and focused in the way that we synthesize all of the information and misinformation about generative AI, how people are talking about artificial intelligence generally with a lot of the headline chasing and armchair opinions of the Twitter sphere around the topic. It's not that we've ignored it, and it's not that we're not even practicing working in those tools, but we wanted to be really cognizant of the advice that we're giving to clients. We weren't going to be an agency that was going to spin up an AI division six days after OpenAI came to market like some of our competitors have. We knew that we had to take a very comprehensive look at the technology, foregoing being the very first tip of the spear, first mover on that, to be able to do a true due diligence to understand the impact. It's still changing every day, so that the analysis that comes out of this podcast today could be different than what we would say 3, 6, 12 months from now. But there's enough concrete for us to start to put a point of view together. And Savannah, you've really led that that research for us. So first, maybe a good topic would be to talk about the historical context of AI and how we have been using machine learning, artificial intelligence at Quiggy since our inception, and what's different about the conversation today as it relates to generative AI.
Yeah, that's a great place to start, because I think part of why we were a little bit quiet in the beginning was we were looking at all of this sudden marketing coverage of AI and kind of scratching our heads, wondering, okay, what is so new to this conversation? Why does it seem like everything is suddenly being called AI? Why are we slapping that label on every new piece of technology, whether it's truly genuinely an AI or if it's some like secret sauce in quotation marks algorithm, if it's just a fancy Excel macro, we're calling it AI now. So part of our process has truly been evaluating, like you said, Ryan, trying to be really methodical and understanding, is this something that's truly net new and plays into the developing technologies that we're seeing come out of, you know, the past 6 months? Or is it just kind of, you know, marketers doing our marketing role and kind of slapping a fresh coat of paint on some old tech? But even then, you know, these tools, part of their benefit is that they can teach themselves. So whether it is truly those generative AI pieces that are capturing that public interest and public attention, like ChatGPT, like Midjourney, or if it's just the marketing platforms that we're using every day start to get a little bit smarter and a little bit faster with their decision making, we've had to be really diligent, to your point earlier, about knowing what this tech actually is, so we feel confident when we're making those recommendations to clients or when we're using these tools internally.
I think because of our place for the past 10 years as a conduit of marketing technology, we've gotten a thicker shield to sales pitches that use buzzwords in general, but certainly ones that purport to have artificial intelligence or machine learning attached to them. We know that a lot of those are black box, smoke and mirror, magic platforms that just suddenly decrease the ROI for a client by 85% just by using one of those magic tools, right? And we know that there's a lot of a lot of gamesmanship in those conversations, to the point where I probably block more emails than I read at this point because of how the volume of technology companies purporting to use AI in a non-differentiated way. So with that, however, the companies that have done that really well have made media buying and programmatic media buying feasible. Programmatic wouldn't exist without artificial intelligence. Programmatic wouldn't exist if you couldn't evaluate a million different inventory placements in a second. We've always had to lean into that, and I think that's why programmatic-based media practitioners are really well positioned to understand generative AI, which is the, as I'm defining it, is the ability to converse with data sets in natural language. And that's obviously a lot different than building a DSP campaign, but a lot of the underpinning on how we learned how to leverage those tools for programmatic buying, I think, do apply to how to look at what's possible and what's not as it pertains to generative AI. So that's why we've taken a little bit of a careful approach, because being such practitioners for a decade now in that field gives us, I think, a really great opportunity to think of innovative ways within the generative AI sandbox to be able to push some really innovative things forward to create automated workflows and to eventually add a lot more efficiency to the work that we do at the as an agency and therefore the work that we do on behalf of our clients.
And that's where I would say one of the benefits that comes from having that sort of like strong programmatic background, to your point, Ryan, is we can kind of mentally differentiate what we're looking at when we're evaluating an AI tool. AI is one of those really large terms that is applied in several different ways. So when we're looking at something and trying to evaluate how it would best fit into a strategy, or if it's something that just gives efficiency to our internal teams, or if it is something truly innovative and brand new that might warrant a really intentional testing strategy, what we've looked at is this something that is a little bit more logic-based, which most machine learning algorithms that we talk about when we're looking at a DSP or a buying platform or some other sort of marketing technology, oftentimes those are really advanced, like if this, then that type of statements. And those are really straightforward for us to say, okay, let's give it this much to test. Let's see if it can really just handle throwing the keys to it or what amount of human oversight is needed here. Whereas with these generative tools that are really capturing the headlines, the public attention, It really feels like the floodgates sort of opened about 6 months ago. And part of what our job has been is to remind clients, for the most part, these tools are still kind of in sort of a public beta test, right? They're really exciting. There's a ton of potential for the future, but they're not quite ready to fully take over the responsibilities of building, you know, a full campaign from start to finish. They're not quite legally safe enough yet to generate your entire creative strategy using them. There's just a lot of questions where it's encouraging to see the future, but we do have that responsibility to ourselves and to our clients and the partners that we work with to say, okay, but let's look at, you know, these 9 different questions that we have about this tool before we truly do genuinely test it the same way we might with a logic-based AI that programmatic has a long history with.
That's a really good distinction. The logical or Boolean logic that can be used a lot of the times in building audiences and federating those audiences to platforms does have a different look and feel to the guardrails that you can put on generative AI. It's harder for us to know the source of content that comes from generative AI. I know Congress has had a lot of questions, and I know that you were literally spent 6 hours on C-SPAN one day when I came into the office watching congressional hearings. I don't know if that was the first time that you've been on C-SPAN on the.
Thankfully, it was only 4 hours, and the time I had done that previously was the TikTok ban question. So very related to my job.
It absolutely was, and I'm glad we had somebody watching. But as you were looking at that and, you know, developing your own point of view as to how generative AI can and should or shouldn't work on behalf of marketers, what are the couple of things that you look at as areas of opportunity and areas of caution when looking at generative AI specifically?
Yeah, the congressional hearing was truly a wild thing to sort of listen to, because at least on the topics that have been relevant to our industry, it was one of the first times I've ever listened to those committee members ask questions that felt really informed and relevant. So for a part of it, it was a breath of fresh air. We didn't have any of those like Senator, we run ads moments. Like
the internet is a series of pipes, I believe. Yeah.
Exactly. The questions being posed seemed very informed and relevant, as I said, and the responses were fairly encouraging from Sam Altman was there, the head of OpenAI. We also had some academics, some AI ethicists, and a lot of their conversation was focused on more far off implications, but things that could affect the way that these tools develop. So part of their concern, obviously, was with privacy. When you are using those tools, when you are prompting them, when you are uploading documents to them and asking them to summarize it, do they learn from that data that you have shared? Do they share it with other tools? If you upload something into ChatGPT, does it become a part of all GPT tools, anything using OpenAI's API? And some of the answers were truly in the realm of, well, if I tell you, I'm giving my competition information that I don't want them to have. We're in an interesting spot with this technology because I feel like we're kind of in like a gold rush and a space race at the same time. So part of the reason I say like so many of these tools are still kind of half baked or in that beta test is because OpenAI making its tools public last year really started that clock and started that race where even though folks like Google and Meta and Microsoft, they'd all been working on artificial intelligence for decades and exploring those type of applications. Really, AI has been a part of programming since, you know, the 50s and 60s, theoretically. But now we're in this spot where, you know, ChatGPT got so much immediate worldwide attention and so much excitement there's really a lot of money to be made in being the first company that gets it right. So a lot of these tools that are rolling out, if we're going to use them in a marketing context, I think it's just important to have that critical eye, that little voice in the back of your head saying, okay, this is an experimental tool. This is half baked. If it's free, the reason I have access to it is because it's learning from how I use it. Like, I am kind of a volunteer tester of this tool.
I know you've used these tools for a little while too. In your actual experience, have you seen, how scarily accurate have you seen things, or where do you, have you seen clear deficiencies? I'll give you an example. I asked it to put a recipe together with some kitchen sink type. I had six things left in my refrigerator. Can I get a recipe for it? And, you know, they wanted me to add eggs to this recipe when it was not part of the ingredients that were listed as the on there. Luckily, I had an egg and was able to finish making dinner for my family. But I was like, yeah, that's a clear error, right? What things have you seen that have amazed you, and what have you seen that is lacking from an accuracy standpoint?
Yeah, that's such a good question, because there's so much we could talk about here. Using your recipe example, I think in general, that's when it's useful to keep in mind that there's a bit of a misconception about how these tools actually work. We get a little bit of projected meaning onto what it is spitting out, but they're not thinking and answering your question. They're just word associations. I've seen a lot of people refer to, especially like those text-based AIs, as word calculators. So in the same way that a mathematical calculator can do a lot of stuff and is extraordinarily helpful, they can't handle things like irrational numbers. So similarly with this technology, you know, we can expect it to do a lot of really incredible formulaic work. We can expect it to be able to synthesize recipes from across its training data and say, okay, egg is normally paired with bacon or pancake or something along those lines. When I have asked it more challenging questions, I've still been really impressed with a lot of the information it spits back out, but it is pretty amateurish. So one example that we did, we prompted it to make a media plan. So we got a question from one of our clients of, hey, how would you recommend this goal? What would we want to do here? We plugged it into ChatGPT, just using the exact sort of language, kind of spiffied up to where we weren't revealing anything proprietary to it. But what it answered when we were looking at it, it was solid. None of it was wrong. It was just a little sophomoric. It looked a lot like what you would see from like a Marketing 1000 class project.
And that's designed that way on purpose to get to the low, maybe not the very lowest common denominator, but to a ninth grade reading level and not a collegiate reading level, right? Or to basic to intermediate thinking and not necessarily advanced. I think that's supposed to be a feature at the moment of where they're trying to put guardrails on the technology. Would you agree with that?
Well, it's not so much, by my understanding, like a guardrail as much as it is just how the tech actually works. So I really appreciated how the Washington Post's explainer laid this out. In terms of how these tools actually think, quote unquote, they know that the sentence, the cat goes to the litter box, makes more sense than the dog goes to the litter box. And similarly, they know that the dog goes to the penalty box probably is not a sentence that makes sense to spit out. But, you know, being human beings, we know there may be some crazy wild thing where a dog somehow gets on the ice and has to get put in a penalty box, right? So it's going to take a little bit of time for any sort of like nuance or wild, wacky things actually make sense, because they've been explicitly trained, to your point, to look for what is the most probabilistically likely group of words that I need to return here. And so since it's trained on, you know, this pile of information, whether it's websites that are hosted on Google's, whatever its hosting source is called, forgive me, or whether it's what has actually been uploaded to it, it is looking for those commonalities and those denominators, because that's just what it's trained to do.
So I'd like to get into a couple more marketing specific questions that seem to come up. I'm sure you'll know a couple of them. One is generative AI going to take the job of copywriters? Do you think that if you were a copywriter, you should be scared for the future of your job?
I think if a brand can use the current state of this technology to replace its copywriting, it's probably not producing copy that's really worth reading, or that is going to resonate with their audiences. I've got a good example of this, actually. McDonald's in Brazil did a really interesting outdoor ad pretty quickly after ChatGPT was released, where they just asked it, what is the most iconic burger in the world? And the answer was the Big Mac. And all they did was take the response from ChatGPT. They kind of color-coded the paragraph to where it sort of looked like a burger. It was very cute. But the more impactful ad was the one Burger King then took out right next to it. And they just asked, and which is the biggest? And then did the exact same art direction. And obviously we know, using these tools, if you plug in the phrase like, which is the biggest right now to ChatGPT, it doesn't have a clue what you're talking about. There's not like really any context for it. So we know that that was a human idea. That was human copywriting used to complement the larger tool. And that is the type of creativity I think we're more likely to see moving forward, rather than this sort of expectation that these tools are going to get so creative that they replace genuine, like responsive, reactful, personable creativity.
That was kind of a softball question to you. But I think it goes back to the responses that you see come out of generative AI tools being pretty sophomoric in their complexity. So therefore, it's probably not the most creative thing that is going to come out. However, the volume that you're able to get of vanilla content, I think especially from personal brand lens, could be helpful in having a baseline of being able to answer certain questions. I could see it from like an SEO perspective. SEO has been gamed for a long time. Anyways, you could answer some key questions that the internet may have about your company, or FAQs, things of that, at least using some of those initial responses to help be fodder for already boring content that's in an FAQ, for instance. So I could still see some uses of it, but certainly from like the creative agency perspective, I have not seen particularly creative or, you know, the inability to citate the research of where some facts come from as well, and knowing that there is not misinformation, but certainly non-accurate facts that come through there. There's still a long ways to go where this is a viable replacement for a researcher, for a copywriter, in my opinion.
Well, and I think, you know, it's not wrong to expect these tools long-term to revolutionize the workplace. I think, you know, there are AI evangelists, there are AI catastrophists, and like most things, I tend to kind of land in that middle. The voices that I trust are the ones saying, I'm really excited for the potential that this can bring, but we're going to have to set those guidelines. We're going to have to recognize that these are new tools. And like every new tech revolution, there's going to be some time needed before we really see what truly changes the world and what's a little bit falling by the wayside. So when I get that sort of like AI anxiety that I think a lot of people feel when they read those pieces saying, you know, Skynet's here, the Terminator's coming, I sort of look back at, okay, email revolutionized the workplace. Having Microsoft Office Suite and just word processors in general, that was a massive tech revolution that changed the workplace forever. And it changed what some jobs look like. But where I have kind of landed after doing all of this research is thinking we need to be comparing this less to, you know, a massive new paradigm shift and more to just the way that tools have evolved over time naturally and how some of them have really become commonplace and others we've seen sort of just fizzle out.
So speaking of guardrails, how have you advised organizations, including our own, on how to bring AI tools into the workplace for testing, for the greater company's understanding, and what advice would you have on the types of people that within an organization that need to have buy-in, who needs to be consulted when considering more formally bringing generative AI tools to the workplace?
It's been a tricky conversation to navigate because so many of these tools are public. So we have to assume at our organization, you know, anyone can make a ChatGPT account and start playing with it. So I worked with our IT department to start a little bit of an exploratory task force of, okay, across, you know, our company, across different roles, we need to find ways that we can lean into this technology a little bit and encourage some experimentation, but have those conversations about our responsibilities, not only to our own staff, but also to our clients. So, for example, some of the questions we're exploring are, you know, do we have a specific AI use agreement in our handbook that says things like, I will not upload my client's private contract information into a public tool. Some of those are low-hanging fruit, and some of these things we truly don't have answers for yet, but the purpose of setting a very intentional, methodical task force up top is so you're not just sprinting at the pace that these tools are being released, but rather you're looking at the technology as a whole and trying to anticipate how my role will change, how my coworkers' roles will change, how our engagement and interaction with our clients will change, and what we should be doing, at least internally, before broader society and broader workplace kind of catches up to the lightning fast speed that the tech is moving in right now.
That deliverance is very much appreciated. And I think is the way that we would advise organizations to look at bringing this in, because it does, there's a risk and reward, and there's certainly a decent amount of risk. In particular, you know, Kolegi has a lot of brands, clients with that are in sensitive categories. So already we have tools in place to regulate the flow of data and information in programmatic technology to ensure privacy, to ensure that we're abreast to regulatory guidelines and policies globally. So in that same vein, we wanted to do a similar exercise with generative AI and are, you know, just starting to bring that framework into the workplace so that we can have a really clear set of guidelines to operate from, because there is a lot of potential to improve efficiency and to you know, really find some compelling uses of content in particular that that generative AI provides for us. So another question I'd have too, just for you personally, where have you seen ChatGPT and Bard being helpful to your work life? What things have excited you? Where do you see some of the easiest opportunities to improve your workflow and efficiencies with generative AI tools?
Yeah, I have gotten so much immediate benefit from the way that large language models have improved captioning and transcribing. I think that's one of their strongest areas. I am someone who typically does use captions when I'm in meetings, especially when I've got multiple people talking at the same time. It just really helps me process what's going on. And I've used them for years, and I always sort of had like a 2-second lag when I was listening to other people speak. Some of that lag has started to go away. They're just getting smarter and faster. But additionally, you know, we were chatting about this, of the difference between really listening and note-taking, and that pressure that people feel sometimes, especially when you're at a conference or a meeting that's really critical. You want to make sure you capture every word, but you're also, at some point, you kind of tune out of the actual conversation and you're just acting like a scribe, you know, or a college student at a lecture who isn't really participating. So looking at some of the transcription tools, even the ones that can be added to webinars and shared afterwards with a full group, I think has really helped us try to stay present in those meetings. And has helped us with that efficiency too, because you don't feel that pressure to say like, whoa, 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 wait, wait, go back. I missed what you said. You know, we know that we'll have that record to look back on, and it keeps us accountable to follow up on the points that we have in those brainstorming meetings that are so easy to forget when you drive home.
It's very hard to both be an active listener and a note taker at the same time. And a big part of communication is active listening. And that's not just listening to the words, but the body language, the facial expressions that your counterpart, the people in the room have. So having that automated, in particular in meetings where you know that there are a variety of types of communication styles, if there's a big, boisterous, big thinker in the room next to somebody who's like pure analytical, I've found being able to go back to my notes there and it has been very valuable. So I think it's something that allows us to be much more present, especially in with video conferencing as more of a norm than an exception. That's certainly part of it too.
What about for you? I mean, I appreciate you've done a really great job of keeping this conversation moving, but I feel like we kind of slipped into you interviewing at this point. What are you excited about, Ryan?
You know, I actually am a little more bullish on the possibility of content to be produced faster and hopefully with more access to research that would take research in particular. It can take a long time to field Google to get in traditional search to be able to find answers. It was a really interesting example at the Forrester conference that we were just at. Their CEO said that he was on an airplane and got the captain giving on the headset that there was going to be a delay, and he said it was because they needed to change the tires. He had never realized that you needed to change the tires on the airplane. So he quickly went into ChatGPT and said, I'm on an Airbus A321. How long will it take to change the tires? And it said, on average, it'll take 2 hours. That was long enough where he was going to miss his connecting flight. So he got on another flight, had his assistant book it. As he was getting off the plane, the captain came on and said, it's going to be about 2 hours until we're able to leave. But he knew it because he was able to get to that answer more quickly. I'm have a personal challenge for myself. I'm not going to use Google search for the next 3 months. I'm only going to use Bard and ChatGPT just to really immerse myself in what this new paradigm is going to look like. I don't think that means Google's like suddenly going away or their business model's upended, but I do think the way that we have interacted for the past 20 years with the search engine is going to be different. The ways that we prompt it, and we're all, instead of becoming creators, I think are going to ultimately become better editors. I think that the journalistic mentality of editing will be, in fact checking is going to be even more critical and important, especially as, and this isn't something I'm excited about, this is a fear that I have, but it's going to be a lot easier for to automatically mimic human behavior as far as like made for advertising websites. There were, the ANA had a big thing on the percentage of spend going to, for made to advertising websites. Coeggy has sniffed those out for a long time. We have 60,000 websites on our blacklist, but it's going to be a lot easier to mimic those sites using natural language processing. So that's a little scary, and I think where it's going to be harder to sniff out what's real and not on your social news feeds, etc. So it's going to be important for everybody to be their own journalist, their own fact checker, and to start to be able to take that mentality to their interactions on the web in general.
And that's where I'll return to a question you asked me earlier about advice I would give. My two biggest pieces that I have been sharing with our teams and with our clients over and over are related to misinformation and the need for fact checking. The first being just the simple fact that most of these public tools, their knowledge, if you will, cuts off in 2021. That is when they stopped inputting with training data. So they're still learning based on what users are uploading to it. But if we think about, you know, how much the world has changed already since 2021, I know it wasn't that long ago, but particularly, you know, we have so many clients who are in sort of that healthcare and pharma space, and, you know, their technology advances quite rapidly as well. If we prompted GPT for, you know, a history and timeline of a specific medication, for example, or a specific disease state, it's not going to have the most accurate information, and it's not going to have the most up-to-date information. Whatever it has is whatever it was trained on. So you do have to do your due diligence to remember these tools don't have access to the full internet and all of the gated knowledge that might exist in like a medical journal, for example. Which leads me to my second piece of advice, which is to keep in mind that they make stuff up. And even that is personifying them a little too much. They're not doing it intentionally. But if anyone listening isn't familiar with this, look up the term AI hallucinations, and you'll get a good explainer of how just because the technology is really functioning as a word calculator, it's not going to return an answer that says, I don't know the answer to your question. They have a tendency to truly just craft out of thin air. So there was a case of like an attorney who wrote a briefing for a judge using ChatGPT, and he didn't triple check all of the cases that it had cited. And he found out that most of them were fake and they sounded really legitimate. It was like Gonzalez versus the state of Washington concluded that blah, blah, blah. And it was the judge who did that due diligence of fact checking and looking through and ended up throwing out the full case. So stakes are often a little bit lower in marketing, but still really critical to keep in mind when you are using these tools for that research is that you can't solely use these tools for research. They should really be an ideation or a starting place.
Yeah, that's incredibly important. The research part and the fact checking still needs to be done today the old school way. You need to go to the sources, look those things up. It's the same as not just trusting Wiki because it's on the Wikipedia page, right? It's a long way from replacing a research analyst, that's for sure. But where it has more promise, in my opinion, would be a couple of, would be maybe in like organic social for headline generation, looking at paid search and volume of headlines and descriptions and keywords. And as I said earlier, also SEO and being able to answer some of those base questions that the internet may be asking around topic that you want to have authority in. Those are places where I do think you should be looking at generative to help help put at least the foundation and framework and into an argument. It shouldn't be the whole thing though. And if you're as silly as the attorney who's copy and pasting a you know, something as important as a court case briefing that you're putting in front of a judge, you shouldn't have that job now. You're skipping many steps, and generative AI may never get to that, to a place where you're going to be able to have full trust in the what's behind it. But it is a good way of modeling the base of the internet, right? It's almost, and this is probably why Reddit has a fight with generative AI right now and scraping it, right? It is a way of getting that baseline of how the internet feels about something.
Well, and we haven't talked very much about image generation yet, because that is an area that is extremely under legal scrutiny right now. So our sort of blanket opinion has been to not use any sort of open AI product for image generation. But still, I found in terms of like how we can use it internally, it's especially helpful for that ideation and just collaboration, especially for folks like us who don't have like a big creative background. I know you never want to be the person talking to a creative guy, asking him to like make it pop, right? Or give that other sort of type of feedback. So instead, this, I have found it be really helpful to say, okay, this is the sort of aesthetic, this is the vibe, this is where we expect the client will be happy if they see this type of imagery. Or, you know, I can't even draw stick figures. So if I wanted to put like a storyboard or something in a pitch, it would be helpless for me to try to do it myself, but it would also be kind of a waste of time to tap internal people to try to do it for me. If it's just for a really high level exploratory conversation, you can use these tools for things like that without getting into hot water. I think it's mostly just our general point of caution to have that human oversight before you truly put a budget to something and try to set it live.
Yeah, I agree. At least in my limited use of Midjourney's of the world, the prompts to get something to look okay even are really complicated. And the prompts for generative AI, for the, at least on the OpenAI and Bard side, are much more straightforward. So the journey has a little bit of work to do, I think, to from the prompt side to make it more accessible.
Well, and hey, maybe we'll be back here in 6 months talking about how Gen AI has developed since we last spoke.
I bet we will. So thanks again, Savannah, for your time and the 7 years of you know, partnership that we've had at Kawagi too. It means the world to me. You've been a great friend, and it's been awesome to see your development as a professional. So here's to 7 more years of working at Kawagi.
7 more years with the help of AI co-pilots. Let's go.
Yes, let's do it. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and have a great day.
Thank you for listening. Kawagi is an industry-leading performance marketing agency based in the Midwest. We've learned a lot since our founding in 2014 and started the Loop Marketing Podcast to share some of our hot takes on marketing trends we're following, best practices we've discovered, and actionable tips for improving your digital strategy. We'll see you next time.